Hi, I'm David Miles. Welcome to the Miles from Home podcast. Nice to have you here. I've got a great conversation coming up with Jeremy Dutcher. This was a conversation that was first broadcast on YouTube Live. Miles from Home on YouTube Live, a not so late night talk show. So you'll hear some references that, you know, that might be kind of confusing. It's because we did it live on YouTube. But it was a great conversation, and I really want to share it with you on this podcast. You see, Jeremy Dutcher is a special artist. He is an incredible artist with a brilliant mind. He's got technical skills like crazy. He can play piano. He's a great singer, but he has got a broad world view. And because of that, he can take on big issues. We're always looking to take on big issues, it feels like, right? Artists, politicians, activists, we're all trying to do it, you know, in tweets and essays and speeches. But nothing moves the needle, folks, like a great work of art. A great work of art can make you feel differently, you know? Not just think differently, but make you feel like for a moment you're in someone else's shoes. And that is the root of all social change. That's empathy, folks. That's what it's about. And Jeremy Dutcher did that with his first album. It won a Polaris Prize. It is so moving. If you have not listened to his first record, you gotta go out and listen to it now. Go out and listen to it and then listen to the conversation. It is transformative and it truly makes you feel colonization differently. It's one of those things where you can read so much about it, but then within minutes of listening to this record, you'll feel it differently. And that is a very powerful achievement. And it is a great honor to get to chat with Jeremy. Generous guy, amazing mind. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. So sit back and relax and enjoy Jeremy Dutcher on the Miles from Home podcast. There you go. How are you?
I'm so well. How are you doing?
Oh, it's nice to see you. And you can hear me fine?
I can hear you. It's coming. It crumbed through like a bell.
You just look beautiful, Jeremy. You look beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, I showered just for this.
First time in months. Out of quarantine, I mean, and into the shower.
Who am I looking good for? You know, I'm. It's just me in here. So it's been a lot of lessons in self. Hood.
Yeah, self-care.
In these times, and trying to understand what it means to dip into a solitude that is uninterrupted. You know, this is, and as you know, this is so rare for people in our profession that we get extended periods of time where we're just sitting and able to expand on artistic ideas and really like dive into it.
Yeah, do you consider yourself a pretty social? Are you an extrovert or introvert? Like, where do you fit on that scale?
It's kind of, touring kind of changed me. I feel like before I was doing that, it like I was telling the story of an extrovert who maybe actually wasn't one, you know? You know, just based on I guess, just the social setting around me, I feel like I stepped into a role of sociality that was maybe beyond myself. And now that I can construct a world that I choose, I think it's a little more close to home and a little more solitary and a little more, just my family around me. Yeah. And just the people, you have to. Anyway, I draw a smaller circle these days, but with pleasure, I do that. You know,
right, it's good.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. You know, it's been a theme. It's been a bit of a theme. I talked with Matt Mays, you know, and Matt Mays, I don't know if you've seen him. I mean, he's a really gregarious performer, really outgoing. Yeah. And he said much the same thing was that, you know, the perception is that he's actually really outgoing. And for a long time, he kind of thought he was. But at the same time, he's kind of thinking during this time. And also just as he toured more and more, he realized that he was actually quite introverted and needed that time. to pull it.
I think it becomes a balancing act too, right? I think because we're in the business of extroversion, going and doing shows and you know, inviting people into our heart for an evening, but over and over and over again, I feel like it there's a bearing of self that wearing down is such the wrong way that I'm trying to express this, but you know what I'm saying? After a while, there's a certain sense of balance that needs to be reconciled, you know? Yeah. And I think for me, yeah, this time has been that, like, you know, because I was going for like 3 years as soon as this record came out, like on tour, you know. Oh, like so
I was
busy.
Watching it and going, wow, it was an intense like, run.
Yeah, it was unfathomable almost. And I just like, I was like, just ride it out until it, you know, you never know. Like, you know, I longevity for me is never assumed. I had a very particular, you know, this music that I released came out in a very particular cultural moment that allowed me to speak into something that I think was bigger than myself or what I had created, you know. And I think I wanted to speak into that void and hold that space in a responsible way. And, you know, I think there hasn't been many of us, so much to say, you know, mm-hmm. out there in the public sphere, saying stuff, you know, with the notable exceptions of, you know, of course, Buffy St. Marie or like A Tribe Called Red or Tanya Tagach, you know, it's like there hasn't been many of us. Yeah. So, you know, there's a sense of wanting to hold that space in a way that honors the community that you come from. And, you know, I think, yeah, certainly I wanted to bring to light with this first record a sense of urgency around our language, because we're right now in kind of the fight of our life right now to preserve our language and to make sure that it's going to last even the next generation. You know, we've had this huge shift, like it's a total 180 in the last you know, a couple generations where, you know, when my mom was growing up, it was like, that was the language of every day, you know, it's like the first language she knew. And now we have a scenario where we have less than 100 fluent speakers left. And so, you know, this happens very quickly, and it's not by chance that it happens too. We need to look at the things like the residential school system and the way that
It was by design.
For sure. You know? And so, and I think, you know, if we can change that story that quickly by design, we can also redesign ourselves out of it too, right? And I'm a really big advocate for that. And you know, and of course we need to be highlighting the issues and the problems, but also, yeah, bringing the solutions to the table and thinking about, where we're off to. Because I think, hey, I was just talking about this today with a friend. You know, that record for me when I wrote it, I was creating it with a sense of like future, and like I created it in the future. You know what I'm saying? It's like
a future you wanted to see.
Exactly. You know, yeah. I created that record in a world where our languages were on the radio. Our languages were, you know, on street signs. There was no translation needed because it was just people had a literacy in Wolastoq music that I kind of just assumed that they had, or I dreamed them to have, you know, even if they had no perception of what actually our music even sounds like, or what our languages even sound like, or any of that, because, you know, not many people had known about us before. So I think I hope it opened up a lot of people's hearts to understand that, you know, we're not all just one thing. You know, we have very particular ways of doing things, and, you know, how I represent my contemporary indigeneity is very different from how, you know, the guys in A Tribe Called Red are going to do it, or how, you know, artists like Ken Monkman or something are going to do it, right? Like, there's all these different
I think that's just so interesting. I didn't expect to get into this right away, and I love it. Yeah. I'm glad we did, because I think I've noticed this a lot, and I find it actually happens as much on the so-called progressive side sometimes, is this kind of treatment of a monolithic kind of culture. Like, they, you know, there's one indigenous voice, you know, it's always struck me as being interesting, because and harmful, really harmful, because any knowledge of anyone, of any group of people, you've come to realize that there's great diversity.
in of course.
Any population, let alone a population as diverse as the indigenous population in Canada.
And it's like in that diversity, that's where the beauty lies. You know, that's where the real, that's where the, that's where the meat
is.
You know, it's like the kind of like maybe more homogenized culture that we might go to a powwow and see. That's it's a beautiful expression, and it's one that's been able to keep our cultures alive and in our minds, in our you know, in our very much present in our lives. And that's a very important way of gathering. And yet, you know, there's so many distinct cultural expressions that you don't see at a powwow, you know, and that are very much rooted, you know, mine was very much rooted in a sort of like, in a research kind of, anthropological, more like, that kind of context. But, you know, everyone's, you know, using, encountering their identity in a different way with regards to how it relates to their artwork, right? And so for some people, it's not even a consideration. You know, they might be, you know, very indigenous, and yet, you know, their work speaks nothing to that. And I think that's what, as soon as we can include that in indigenous music, then I'll be satisfied.
Yeah,
you know,
man. Because it was one thing I kind of was thinking of, you know, is that I have been actually, even in explaining this, and when I talk about you, I actually feel it's kind of limiting to say indigenous artist Jeremy Dutcher. I don't say that. I don't want to say that. Doesn't feel right. I want to say artist Jeremy Dutcher. You know what I mean? Though you refer to your indigenous identity, it's super important what you do. Of course it's not. And as you said, you know, when we can kind of accept all versions of what indigenous people are creating, whether it be, you know, as you said, a more of what we expect, or something that's straight up hip hop. You know what I mean? Straight up, totally different. It's more influenced by Tupac than it is by traditional indigenous culture. That's legit too.
Totally. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I love that. And I think that's the richest that I hope that we can get to. And that's why, like, you know, things like the, with the Junos, you know, they have this like one category of like indigenous music, you know, and it's like, well, this is kind of the only category that's grouped together by a culture, you know, lots of other artists get considered in all these different categories, like, you know, best album or like all these kind of things. And so often I think our artists get sideloaded into like indigenous music, right? And like, because that's from the cultural place that we're creating from, that then becomes the most important thing about it, which, you know, I see these like an award like that as a very important placeholder, or like a space taker in these institutions, you know, and I'm very grateful for those people that advocated for these space holders to take place. And yet I think we're at a moment now where I hope that we can grow beyond that and understand that in what indigenous creators are doing right now is the music of this time. And it's speaking to something that, I hope as a country we can all kind of look at and grapple with right now. And it seems like we are.
I think so. I mean, I think it actually is a similar trajectory to hip hop. Hip hop was a category, you know, for a long time it wasn't a category, then it was a category, and then it moves beyond. Whereas like you get the biggest songs of the country of the year, they weren't considered in that category because for a long time they were just hip hop songs. You know what I mean? But now it's moved beyond. And I think a lot of it has to do with value, where we place value, right? And I think that's what's really happening, I hope, but especially with all this art, like the Renaissance that we're watching, people are starting to finally understand the value in as you said, that richness, all of that, the little differences, the languages that were almost gone. They were almost gone. I mean, I think about like the backpacking culture a lot. I think about this. I think about the backpack. People who travel to the highest, farthest places in Thailand to find remote communities. Do you know what I mean? And they brag about it. And it's like, I found a community that's only 100 people speak this language. And in New Brunswick, you know, we have communities like
right next
it's right there. You don't have to go to Thailand, dude. Go across the river. Like,
Yeah, you know, and I think that what I've been encouraged by in this last like couple of years, I guess, like getting to do this project and speak about indigenous language and the precarity of it, but also the reemergence and resurgence of it, is like, you know, getting to talk to allies and people that, you know, might not have any business learning our language, you know, but I think they understand it. They, you know, they have this idea that, like, you know, why, you know, I could go learn, you know, any language in the world. And yet, you know, there's something about being able to relate to the people that have been here for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And I have a knowledge of this land and this place that is embedded in the language and runs so deep, you know? And so I think a lot of allies are like looking to that and realizing that and seeing that, you know, that work of linguistic revitalization can be everybody's work. Yeah. Because all the resources are out there, trust and believe. You know, I think we're in this amazing digital age right now where information is so readily available, not just for our people, but for everybody, about our culture and our languages and how they work. And I think that's a really exciting moment for us as people that really want to see it survive, you know, because just even like up until 30 years ago, we didn't even have a writing system, you know? And so, yeah, just in that short time, you know, we've come to like this really critical moment where it's like, okay, we take one path or the other. It's like, we either put our, you know, our real focus and energy into saving this language, or it's what, like, we just let it die. Right. And, you know, it's not words that die. It's worldview.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And one that is so distinct to this place, you know, like I'm saying, you know, and this kind of came home to me when I was studying. So I went to opera school. I was studying as a classical singer for a little while. And when you go to these kind of schools, they really encourage you to take a European language, you know, because often these operas are in Italian or German or French or something, you know. And anyway, so I was focusing on German Lieder, and so I was into taking German, and you know, I was studying for one of these tests, and you know, these, like, I don't know how familiar you are with it, but they have these like long words, you know, so trying to like cram these long words into my head.
Compound and, words. It's like a million compound, you know, words in one. Yeah.
The funny part is that Wollastok works the same way. We have the exact same compound word system. But anyway, I digress. But, you know, it was in that moment of like trying to like fit these words in my head, and just woke up and said, you know, there's a whole country of people that speak that language. It'll be fine. You know, this language only lives here, you know. And so there's something to that. And I think since that day, I've been, you know, it's what's on my mind when I wake up. It's what's on my mind when I go to bed. And honestly, I probably spend more time doing language work than music work these
really?
Days.
Really, so fascinating. I gotta go back okay. Because where, like, let's talk about your upbringing. Let's talk about your parents. Talk about your parents. Where did this desire? Where did this interest in learning the language, the culture, the all of this and the worldview, it's so, I find it so interesting, because at one point, as you say, it's kind of, you're looking really inwards. You're looking at something small, microscopic, very local, but you have such an amazing expansive worldview. And I'm guessing it came from your parents.
I think so. Yeah. Sweet Stephen and Lisa Dutcher. They are, just so lovely. I love them so. So my mother was a nurse for a really long time in community. So right in Fredericton at St. Mary's First Nation, she was the community healthcare worker there for a long time. And then she like moved to academia. She was teaching at UNB in their nursing program there, like trying to get Indigenous nurses like on board and like getting them into the nursing program. And my father, he also taught at UMB. He was like a history prof. So he taught Canadian Native relations, but he's white. So there's this really interesting encounter within my household of this, like, you know, I always like kind of laugh at these like terms like reconciliation. Well, it's like, okay, well, I've been living that my whole life. You know, the story of Indigenous and non-Indigenous Canada coming together is my life, you know. So, you know, I think I that really shaped my perspective, I think, and how I came to think about, you know, identity. And I think the ways in which, community is codified within contemporary indigenous communities, the reserve system has been such a particular thing, right? Because it's really created this divide within our people of people living on reserve and people living off reserve, right? And so, and I kind of was halfway between. So like my parents really wanted to school us down in the city. And so we would do did my schooling in Fredericton. And then in the summer we would go up to Negulkuk or Tobik, where my mom comes from. Okay. But you know, so I had this sense of like
you were constantly bouncing between the two worlds,
which is like, so you get very and in a sense you feel like, oh, I don't really fit in many places, you know. But later in life you sort of come to understand that as a very as a sacred perspective, you know, as a powerful place to be on that fence, you know, and able to see both perspectives in maybe a clear light. Anyway, so I guess, even though we were spending a lot of time off reserve, my mom was very, she made it very clear that we needed to know who we were, you know. And I think she really, from a young age, emphasized that our culture was a very important thing, you know, and that we had space to express its importance in our family, you know. So
we were involved in... Did she speak the language at home?
Yeah, so like, we were like coming up, it was like mostly English just because my father, and like we were speaking at home. And then like when we would go and visit my grandmother, she would speak with her. And then like getting to hear her talk with her sisters and her aunt. And so there was always like, even from a very young age, there was this sense like, oh, something's going on. Like something is, we're not talking how we usually talk, you know? And it wasn't until later. And you know, there were like commands like, you know, go get this or whatever, you know, come inside or all these kind of like maybe short commands. But you know, I wouldn't describe myself as being like a fluent speaker when I was a kid, you know, just because it was more of a casual language or something that I heard around me. But it also made it, because I had heard it around me, it made it super easy when I sort of started. It was in college, actually, right after this sort of like German test epiphany of like, okay, that's it. I'm buckling down. Like every day is dedicated to gaining a level of fluency that I know will help me in the work that I need to do to keep this language alive,
right?
You know, because like there's just no resources is the problem. You know, right now we have 4 books in our language total.
Wow.
That's it.
Yeah.
And one of them is the Bible. So, you know, it's like there's such a limited scope of what language learners right now have at their disposal to learn. And so for me, the work of my positionality, because I have that access to, you know, higher education, I have that access to understanding the language, being around the language, and an increasingly deeper understanding of it written too. Because there's this, I'm having this beautiful thing with my mother right now, because she grew up, this was her first language. But she, you know, she was growing up at a time when they didn't have a writing system. And so she speaks it, you know, and understands it very clearly, but doesn't necessarily, you know, is just learning now to put it to paper. Whereas for me, I very much learned from the, like, from a book and from a paper way.
Okay.
And so now I get to go back and she's helping me with my pronunciation. Yeah. I help her with the writing system. And it's like this, it's a really beautiful way to do it, you know.
And during in these academic environments, you know, high school, university, was there any curiosity about your identity? Was there ever anybody say, you know, it's kind of cool that you know this other language that you're exposed? It was no interest.
I mean, New Brunswick, I wouldn't exactly call it a hotbed of diversity.
Right.
So I think, you know, I wasn't necessarily worried that they weren't talking about it. I was just happy that they weren't making fun of me for it.
Right.
And, you know, I had a couple other things that they could make fun of me for. So they were looking over here and not looking at this. And right. I thought that was fine. But, you know, I think, yeah, for me, it was kind of this like thing that, you know, we just didn't talk about. And, you know, we would go at the end of a, you know, school day or on the weekend to the Friendship Center, you know, in the city where like Native people gather. And we would, you know, we would have drum group there and we'd be singing and feasting and all this kind of stuff. It was community. But then, you know, you go to school. And because even too, there's this distinction because this is the reserve kind of system and thinking where it's like, because I don't come from St. Mary's, I don't hang with the St. Mary's kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And so like, there's this like distinction between like, even within ourselves of like, groupings and like, oh, you're not with us. Oh, you're not from the reserve or you're not this. Right. And so, I guess I just like, I looked inward and like looked within my family and there were some really, key knowledge keepers that surrounded me as I was growing up, like my siblings and this woman who became a really important mentor to me named Maggie Paul, and so I took strength from them and I guess I let my identity flourish in those spaces rather than, you know, I don't, to be honest, like in my high school, like, or even in like the Fredericton area, I didn't know a lot of Native people or like a lot of my age, you know, young ones. I was always talking to the elders, the old people.
Hanging on.
Because they had all the knowledge, you know, they had the life experience, had the language, they had the dances and the songs, you know? And so for me, that was always like, I didn't socialize with a lot of people my age. I was always like talking to the older ones, you know.
Oh, and you're the youngest. Are you the youngest of four?
Yeah.
So you know I am too. I'm the youngest of four boys.
It's amazing. Wow. We're such a special place in the order of things, you know.
Yeah.
The baby.
That's right. That's so cool.
I love it. And are your siblings all musicians too, or what's,
they all play music? They all play music. They do other things professionally now, but they're all great, great musicians.
You're the one who hung on to the dream, eh?
That's right. I think that's part of being the youngest. You take big risks because they kind of, you know, my parents were strict, you know, so the first ones were, you know, it was bigger risk for them to say, oh, I'm going to be an artist. You know what I mean? By the time I came around, they're like, okay, just,
do,
you know.
Do whatever you want. Just be happy.
Yeah, almost. But, you know, I want to talk about Maggie Paul a bit because okay. I've heard about her. You've spoken about her. I read about her. Tell me a little bit about Maggie Paul.
Oh, God, I can't shut up about her. My God, I love her so much. So Maggie Paul is a song carrier. And she's actually, so she doesn't actually come from the Wolustok people. She comes from the Passamaquoddy people. And the Passamaquoddy are a nation in actually on the stateside. So they're in Maine. So the whole thing is like we didn't cross the border. The border crossed us, right? And so we have these territorial distinctions between like Canada and you know, America. It doesn't really work like that for us in our way of thinking, right? So why I make this distinction is because we speak the same language too, right? And so Passamaquoddy and Wolustok are the same language, essentially the same culture, but they were split by the border and then they took very different histories, right? Anyway, so she is from that side, but came over and lives on this side. So she's been living in Fredericton at St. Mary's First Nation for since I think the 70s. So she's been a well-known elder in the Fredericton area, has one of the most. How do I speak about this voice in a way that is? I don't know. I love the human voice. I think it is one of the like most beautiful creations of all. And I think there have been a couple human voices in my life that have shook me in a way that I was changed afterwards. I'm sure you've experienced this too. Mm-hmm. I think everyone who loves music or anyone who loves sound, I think, has been shaken by a certain kind of sound. Anyway, her voice, I've never heard another voice like this. It's just, it is for me, I always joke, like, it takes me a while to get to Spirit Place, you know, but the, as soon as she opens her mouth, she's right there, you know, and it's like
the gateway, direct,
you know,
gateway.
And it's like, fuck, I need a whole show to get there. But she is like, there's just such a way in which she carries her voice that is really beautiful. Anyway, so she is she's just an elder among our people, and she's she kind of took me under her wing. She's a sweat lodge keeper, and so she has a lot of ceremonial songs too, and so she invited me in her lodge and taught me a lot of songs, but also told me about lots of different stuff. And one of those things was these wax cylinders that actually became the catalyst to the album, right? And so I didn't actually know anything about that collection that lived at the museum until she told me about them. She said, hey, you know, and it, because she had gone and done some of the work before, you know, she had gone and looked at one of the songs and brought it back, but she didn't have the time or the resources to sit down and do all the full, like, scope of the work, you know?
And so where these songs were recorded.
Mm-hmm. These were recorded among our ancestors in the, like, early 1900s, so like 1903 to 1911.
Yeah.
So there was this anthropologist who went out and he lived among our ancestors and collected all sorts of stuff. So it wasn't just the songs, but he also collected stories and photographs and all kinds of things. But particularly for me, as a musician, I was really curious about these songs, you know, and he collected over 100 of these traditional songs on these wax cylinders. And so this is like proto recording technology. This is before we had records. We were recording on these little, like, kind of like a pop can hollowed out of wax, you know, and then it etches onto that cylinder the sound waves, and then you can read it back.
Spin? Is that how it
you've seen it? Yeah, you've probably seen it before. It's so brilliant.
So cool.
Yeah, so I got a chance to go and in Gatineau at the Canadian, what do we call it now? The Canadian Museum of History, I believe it's called, in Gatineau. I went there for a couple weeks and sat with the collection and was just so blown away, like beside myself with these like beautiful melodies. And so, you know, Maggie is a huge part of that journey, you know, and she really pointed me in that direction, you know. It's like, and she did it in such the way that, like, this is so how our elders do it, you know. They, like, when a young person comes and sits with them often, you know, it's not about ever really telling that person what to do. But what Maggie said was, like, you know, she told me about this collection and this archive, and she said, you know, wouldn't it be nice if somebody brought that back, you know? Wouldn't it be nice if somebody went into that museum and brought it out for the people? Because she said, you know, that's where it needs to be. It needs to be back with the people. And so, you know,
That's wisdom. That's wisdom. That's what it sounds like.
You know, and so for me, this whole album and the expression of it was just, in a way, to satisfy that request from Maggie. You know, because her whole intention was to bring that back to the people, and now we got those songs and those melodies, you know, on radio in the East Coast. Now we got our little kids learning it in the schools, and it's been really exciting to see the many manifestations in which this work has now begun to live, you know.
That's very interesting. So these songs have taken on a life outside of just your project.
Absolutely
interesting. So yeah. At what age did you meet her and start having these conversations about songs?
Oh gosh, you know, she's kind of been around my whole life. You know, there's pictures of us when, you know, I was maybe, you know, 5 or 8 wow. or 10 or so. She's always kind of been around. But we sort of took on a more sort of intentional mentor relationship in the last, you know, 10 years or something, you know. And so it's just been a matter of sitting with her and getting to hear the journey of our, you know, it was really just, it started with just sitting with her and asking tons of questions, you know, because, you know, it's just, I was so curious about her, just, you know, whatever, like, well, we'll get to talking about like the music, but even just her journey from, you know, from over in the States to, and how she came here and, you know, when she, you know, how she picked up the drum. And because, you know, for, we're in a very particular cultural moment when it comes to like indigenous issues or indigenous identity. You know, I think a lot about, you know, my mother's generation, but also even above that, you know, that older, that elder generation, it was not cool or popular to be indigenous. It was not something interesting that people want to talk about at a party. Yeah, right. It was something that you hid, and it was something that was potentially unsafe if people knew about it, right? And so, you know, I always lay down my like sincerest humility at the feet of these people, you know, because I think within the survival of our elders is the story of survival of, oh my God, humanity the world over. Like they've been out here and they've been doing it and keeping our culture and language alive so that we
under crazy circumstances.
Yeah, you know,
circumstances, of course.
Yeah, and then so our generation is now sitting. We've kind of been the first ones, you know, because the last residential school closed in 1996, like in my lifetime, you know, and so thankfully I didn't have to go to one, but you know, it was a close miss.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I think, you know, we are part of that first generation that is not directly steeped in the trauma of colonization. You know, of course, it's still around us and we still have to, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, Chantel Moore and Rodney Levi, those two killings that happened in New Brunswick just last month, you know. And yet, I think there's this general sense that we have moved into a place where our lives aren't necessarily in danger all the time, you know, and I think even that is a place of like we can take that moment to celebrate and then also move forward from that and think about all these amazing indigenous young creators that are just doing so many beautiful things. And it's just so amazing to see how, you know, one project spawns another one, like, you know, I can't tell you how many, you know, people after shows and stuff come up to me and say, you know, the work you're doing with your like archive and those ancestor songs, what you're doing, like, I want to go and do that with my.
Yeah, because they have a whole other set of songs.
Exactly. You know, it's not just, that's the thing, you know, it's like coast to coast to coast to coast.
Of course.
Like, all of our material culture is sitting in these institutions. And for me, I think I had hoped that this work, you know, as much as it talks about language, I think it's also talking about the nature of museums and the acts of repatriation and what that could actually look like and getting, you know, these material cultures into the back into the hands of the people in which they come from.
Yeah.
You know,
I think one of the really interesting things, and we're, you know, to get into the musical side of what you did, which was not taking these melodies, taking these musical these recordings, and then reharmonizing, you know, doing what you did, which was orchestrating, reharmonizing, singing them yourself, using the audio. It was just such an amazing. I was so moved. I'll speak out. Firstly, is that you had spoken to me before you had done this project and kind of outlined the vision. And this was over the phone. We didn't know each other at all. We were just having a chat about a project and you outlined the vision and it was so grand and so beautiful and ambitious. My first thought was, great idea. Good luck. You know, like, you know, first album.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen. First album, that doesn't happen. And then I hear it and I was in my backyard with my wife listening to it, crying, going, I've never heard anything. It was so beautifully executed. Uh-huh. But one of the things I think was so cool is that, and speaking of museums, is this term that we use, primitive, right? I wanted to talk about this because it's a loaded, it's a term that I think forever museums and musicians. And you worked it right into the classical world, right into the heart of it, right? Mm-hmm. Where those melodic ideas for so long, indigenous artistic contribution would always come with the other term, would be considered primitive. It was, well, there's Beethoven, and then there's right. And then there's this. You just flipped it right over. You just like suplex, screw that. Yeah. You know, and I thought that was so powerful, you know what I mean? Just like that. And I mean, I think this is, again, it's this reevaluation, but that is such, it's a term that still pops up every once in a while in museums and this, and looking back at these cultures. And I want to talk about that a little bit, you know, because I think it's a really interesting thing.
I mean, I think it's really important how we name, you know, I think naming and language is so powerful. And I think, yeah, things like primitive, but even terms like, to be honest, like the ways that this music has been characterized as world music, I think is like, it particularly falls under a category of like, okay, it's just confusing to me because all music is music in the world, you know, and it's, I guess because it's not in English or not necessarily for like a white mainstream audience, I guess like it's considered something other. But I guess it just like, all that's doing is just pointing us to power, right? And to I guess who's in the rooms making the decisions about what gets called what, right?
That's exactly it.
Yeah. And so I guess what I hope is that we can start to democratize that, those powers, and have our people in the room and having these discussions, because trust and believe that we're not calling ourselves primitive. Of course. There's nothing, you know, it's like this is there's a real intentionality. And I guess for me, that's I struggle with this dichotomy my whole, I guess, like really conscious life. Right. Because coming, I guess I started a classical music program when I was 17 and came out when I was maybe 21, and then started writing. Actually, I started writing this record when I was in school. And wow. So really this was kind of a response, or like kind of a, what do you call this? Like a shrug off of the classical music convention. You know, and even the ways that we talk about classical music, like who's classic, like who's, how are we codifying that? Like who gets to decide what that entails? Like for me, I think there's a strong case to, you know, call it Western art music because that's what it is, you know? And I think there's lots of music of the classical period of many different cultures that I think once we start to, level that playing field a little bit and start to, if you really extrapolate it out, it could be just a conversation about white supremacy too, if I'm being frank.
No, but that's, you know? I mean, that is essentially by saying this is here and this is, and by, because primitive is a normative, it's a term that is meant to demean.
Right.
Right. It's meant to say that it's not of the same refinement. This melody, this artistic contribution is not of the level of refinement as this. Well, what's the difference? Well, it comes from two different groups of people.
Which for me is like, I think of as laughable, because I think about, you know, all the care that is taken within indigenous communities of that mentor-student relationship and just how, you know, to learn, to really learn a melody correctly, it takes years, you know? And that is like, that is a kind of embodiment, and you know, I think what's beautiful about our singing tradition too is like, music is done as a form of action too, right? Like we sing the canoe song as we're in the canoe going down the river. We sing the corn planting song as we're planting the seeds for the corn. You know, it's like it's all related to these various activities. And so I think there's an embodiment too that we don't respect when we start to talk about pedigree or quality. That I think we miss. And so I think for me, all I was doing was just putting that, like leveling that playing field. You know, and this, like, starting that conversation from a place where both are honored, and it's not about how the tools of Western art music can decorate indigenous melody. It's about how indigenous thought form and music creation continuum, which goes back a real long time, how that can be in conversation with the instruments of an orchestra, which I believe are very beautiful. And I don't sell out this this way of making music at all. I think there's so much beauty in that canon of music, and yet when we choose to value only certain kinds of sound making, we lose.
That's right. We lose. We
stop losing.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, it's true. We lose, right? That's what I mean. That's what I think was so cool about this is it was like a sleight of hand. Mm-hmm. It was like I listened to that record and I'm like, it was a sleight of hand. It was a sleight of hand that turned this whole thing without ever saying anything by doing this, by going, and interweaving these two worlds as equal partners, as partners in this, as you said, musical partners in this, not as a sub, that really changed the conversation, I think, just from the classical perspective, from a musician's perspective, from how it fits into the canon. And what was so interesting is that I think you were, as you said, there's a moment where people have started to go like this. They have those class. You played to classical audiences all over the world. Did you find the resistance or did you find acceptance?
No, like fully just, I mean, I think there's a strangeness to what I offer, which I think makes people go, huh? But I don't mind that so much. I don't mind as long as they're not booing me off the stage. But no, I think, the world over, I've gotten really positive responses from classical audiences. And, I've gotten to collaborate with people like Yo-Yo Ma.
Oh, dude, I'm going to show the audience. I got the picture ready so we can show the audience, buddy. Look at this.
Oh,
remember
God.
The one I sent you? The audience is going to see a picture. There you are, you and Yo-Yo Ma. You can't see it, but that's a beautiful photo.
I'm sure it's stunning.
Oh,
I don't know
amazing.
Which one it is, but I'm
and
sure.
And then there's another one of you guys. A little look at this. And Yo-Yo Ma tapping you on the back, giving you some love.
We're buds, man.
Really?
It was like a real coming together. I think, whatever. I'm not going to like pretend to sit here and like be friends with Yo-Yo Ma. But what I will say is that I think, I was shocked with just how absolutely comfortable I was in his presence. I thought that there might be this just, of course, who he is and like his legacy and everything he's done in his career. I thought, well, okay. So I think fame or this stardom or whatever this does, it's an amplifier, right? And so people go one of two ways, I guess, or really is just turning up the volume on whatever was existing. And I think something that interacting with Yo-Yo showed me was that, like, it's there's so much beauty in going that positive way, in really taking the time to thank every person who's holding a door for you,
right.
Taking the time to, talk to the people that are cleaning the change room, it's taking the time to, talk to people after the show. I was astonished that somebody of his, of what one might think of as, this virtuosic artist that wouldn't make time for people is just one of the most friendliest people that I've ever gotten a chance to meet. Wow. And I was so instantly comfortable in his presence,
Wow. And he was totally open. He was picking up what you were putting down.
Oh my God. Like in a real way. Like, so, the first collaboration that we got to do was part of, the Bach Festival here in Montreal. And, so he did, 3 hours of the entire Bach cello suite. And then
my memory.
Oh my God. It was like, you could hear a pin drop. It was incredible. And then at the end of this show, like all along the tour, he was asking like local artists to come in and collaborate on the final piece. And so this is why I had come. He had asked me to come and sing honor song as and he would accompany. And it was all improvised too. He's like, of course, I mean, yeah.
Wow.
Yo-Yo Ma, you know, he's a wizard. and so that was the first time that we get to collaborate. But then at the end of that tour, he brought together some of his favorite collaborations from that tour. And so I got to go into studio with him as well. And record something, although I don't know if it's like what's happening with it now. I don't know if it's going to come. Anyway, there was a recording session. I don't know what's happening with it. We ate sushi together. It was really fun.
Wow.
I don't know.
Wow.
It was, we were in the, not the Hamptons, but the, it's somewhere in Massachusetts part of world, you know?
Yeah.
In like the, and there was this old church that was converted to a recording studio. And, anyway, blah, 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 Yo-Yo Ma,
that's
you know?
Pretty cool, though. I mean, but it does show the level of, I mean, where the album took you, really, through that world. And playing at all these indie rock festivals at the same time. To be noted, it wasn't just a classical by any stretch, resonating just with the classical audiences. It was
that was the funniest joke for me, is that I got to, like, play that card on everybody. Is like, I got to play everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I was playing concert halls and some of the, like, the most beautiful venues, like the Four Seasons and stuff, you know? And at the same time, I was playing, like, dingy festivals and, you know, and some of them were really nice and others were not. And sometimes we were piling the vans and, you know, it was like, because I guess I was at this intersection of like kind of pop, kind of classical, kind of indigenous, kind of whatever that is, you know, I got away with a lot. And I think that for me was like, it was a fun sense of freedom. And it allowed me to speak to a lot of people, which was really exciting, you know, because I think, these conversations are not one that have been fostered in this country. I think is the simplest way to put that is just like, we haven't been having these conversations up until quite recently. And you know, it's like, it feels like friggin' 10 steps forward and 9 steps backwards sometimes. Did you know? Yeah. Anyway, so I'm very hopeful, I guess, for this project. Like, doing this work and this project made me hopeful, because all the people that came around and to witness it and to come to shows and to be part of the community that surrounds this work, it was a way different crowd than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it was like old people, young people, queer people, not queer people, every race, creed, religion, whatever, you know, it's like, I think there's a certain magic to non-English music too, or, you know, in the way that like, maybe if people, when we separate a literal understanding of something and we zoom into a vibrational understanding and like how it affects us and how sound sits on and in our body, I think it bypasses all this and I think becomes a tool for healing. And I think I was very happy to see it do that work.
I hoped it would. I do think it did. I mean, that's what I was trying to get at the beginning. Is I do it. It I really do, and it manifests itself slowly, and the effect will be over time and everything. But I do think that it moved people, in a fundamental way, in a changing their understanding of really important things. A lot of what we've been talking about, you know,
because it's stories, right? And stories is what moves people. And I think for a long time, our stories, like indigenous stories, had been mediated by somebody else. They had been, for God's sakes, like, you know, all of these like Western films and pretty much for the early part of Hollywood, they got Italians to play us. Like, we didn't even get to play Indians in our own friggin' movies. Right. And so, right now, we are just coming to this place where we're now having real indigenous voices served up to us. And I think it's a real moment right now where we can choose a different path. You know, we have a lot of prophecies and stories in our culture about the path that we are to take together. Because trust and believe, like all of this, the indigenous, non-indigenous relationship, this is all supposed to happen.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I think, you know, we had 500 years ago, we had a choice. And I don't think we chose right. I really don't. And I think this put us down a path of fear and dividedness and individualism that I think is like the ultimate manifestation in Donald Trump, but like is playing out at all sectors of society all the time. That choice, you know, and
the
I think
choice right, being sorry, do you mean the choice of colonization?
I guess, yeah, the choice of colonization. I guess the choice of fear over kinship.
Yeah.
And love, you know, and I think that played out from either side. But obviously, you know, I think there is a power story and a domination story that also took place here, you know, and I think that that really got in the way of the potentiality of that story that we could have told, which is one of relationship and one of mutual respect and
collaboration.
And, yeah, and I think there's such there's such fruitful there's such fruitfulness there at that place of collaborative and of moving together and I just hope that we can take this time to look and transform our own ways of doing things, because trust and believe, it's all of us, right? Like it's in all of our ways of collecting and communicating with each other, and I want to give props to you, my brother, for using your platform
I
have to say it. You know, it enriches.
It's like you said, it just makes it better. It makes my life. These are the conversations I live for. My life is only made better by experiencing the lives of other people, and the more different, the better. I've always believed that.
But my brother, you as a white dude, to go and say this is a transformational message, right? Because there have been generations of people just like you that did not see it this way, and I think you. Like, whatever, I can reach who I can reach and I can talk to who I want to talk to. And yet, you're speaking to a whole different sector of people. And I think that is, and you're speaking some really, and I guess really just holding that space for other voices to come in right now. And I think that is, that's really the work of our time, I think, certainly for allies and for settler folk and for white people, is just to like, to just start to look at those blind spots and, you know, where haven't we been listening or where haven't we been thinking about the least of us, you know? Yeah. And this is, yeah.
I mean, you know? but, and I think in having these conversations, experiencing these conversations for other people listening to them, for me, everybody, it's this reevaluation, right? It's looking, seeing value where we didn't see value. You know, there's so much diversity. You know, it's funny because in some ways there's, you know, we think about New Brunswick as not having diversity. And then when you do that microscope, it's so diverse.
Mm.
There's this rich diversity in the Acadian community. There's, you know, there's indigenous communities that are all different from one another.
Oh my gosh, it's so cool.
Like I think because for a long time I had this international view. I was into traveling. I lived in China. Mm-hmm. I lived in Europe. My dad traveled. I was all about that. And then I started to go, well, wait, what did you take that same view and go and look real close mm-hmm. to you? And you start to see that there's this amazing, as you said, this richness that's all around us that we've for so long just gone, no, that's actually kind of in the way.
Right.
It's kind of,
we're going to put that over here.
Yeah.
Now.
It's actually kind of in the way of where we want to go. And that's kind of a pain. No. Whereas I really believe like it's actually where our strength lies. It's like in all these wonderful, amazing little pockets. And anybody who listens to you speak will realize that because you're such a great, I love you. I love how you speak. I love your ideas. I love your thoughts, your brain, your music, man. It's wicked. So
wonderful.
Yeah, man. It's so what's next? What's coming next? What's in the pipeline?
That's a great question. I think, I tend not to build pipelines. It's against my,
Yeah, what's in the creative pipeline? They're the best types.
Frigg. So I really didn't want to put too much pressure on this time of like, okay, well, you got time now, so you better create something, you know? But I think inevitably I just having the time and space to do it and trying not to put my pressure on it, but also realizing that like, you might not get it again for a while. You know, that was one thing that like, after I put out the first record, it was like, you know, they don't tell you that you should probably make like 3 or 4 records before you release your first one, just in case something happens and it goes well.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you don't have any time to do anything else.
Yeah. Cause then you're just touring. And for me, there's a cycle to creation. It doesn't like happen in the same way. Whereas like for me, when I'm touring, I'm absolutely touring, you know, I'm there to do a show and get as much sleep as possible and hydrate and then do another show. And then that is my extent of my motion. And then when I'm resting, I'm absolutely resting, you know? And for me, I guess the creative process too is kind of like this as well. It's like, it kind of needs to be for me a choice to say like, okay, I'm sitting down and we're going to do it like this now. And so I've been able to do that in this time and I crafted 12 little songs together. I'm going to work with a fellow named Owen Pallett to bring them together and create a little sound world around it. Such a wonderfully delicate musician. Oh, and wow. I can't wait to collaborate. Cool. But also, yeah, like I was saying, like the stories and the languages are really what's keeping me most busy these days. Like, you know, when I was going and doing that archival research for the first record, you know, as I was mentioning, like, there wasn't just songs that were collected. There was also photographs and stories. And the stories is like this huge piece of mystery to me that I really wanted to, like, you know, as I was saying, there's about 4 books. And so there's a whole dearth of literature that I think we could just blow all of this into. The problem is like it was all collected in the early 1900s. And so it's in a writing system that isn't accurate to today's writing system. And so what I've been doing is like taking those stories and writing them out in our contemporary writing system so that it can be understood by our young people today. Cool. And so, but this is a lot of work because it's like volumes of stories.
Yeah.
So that's been my big work, but I'm also, doing a couple of composition commissions. I just moved to Montreal. So trying to like, live in a home this is my first time living alone. So I'm like, doing that old thing.
Yeah.
that's what's next for me. I'm really trying not to, like, I don't know when touring is going to happen again or like when live shows are back. I don't know. Do you have a sense of what that looks like on your end?
No, I think it's going to be, it's going to be a while. I'm just holding tight.
I just kind of shrug when people ask me. I'm like,
No, I got no sense. So I'm just trying to, you know, I knew that I wasn't going to survive if I tried to gear up and just go, I'm going to tour. I'm going to keep it. I got to find a different speed. We're in a different place.
Yeah.
And it's about sustenance, maintaining a creative fire, maintaining good mental wealth. My thing is I've limited in my household, my kids, my wife, our goals are peace and harmony.
Yes.
Above all else, that's ambitious enough. Let's focus on peace and harmony.
Right.
And then we'll move from, and so that's the focus of the next year.
Just peace and harmony.
That's it. Yeah.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, but, yeah. Oh man. Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for this.
It was such a pleasure. I feel like, you know, let's hop on. Let's make it a weekly thing.
Oh,
let's hop
I love on. It. And I know there's been people who've been commenting and have been loving this. And right, so thank on. You. Thanks so much. Are there any organizations at home or in Canada that you want people to support? Any organizations that you want to draw some attention to? I know this is a lot of pressure, so don't worry.
Yeah,
about
no,
it.
Totally though. Oh my God, there's always organizations that I want to shout out. Depending on where you live, of course, but I know we have, since we're both Fredericton boys, We both have a lot of connections to that place. And so I wanted to hopefully draw people's attention to something that's going on right now. I've been talking a lot about language. It's something very dear to me. And right now, in New Brunswick, we're talking about building the first Wolastoq language immersion school.
Amazing.
And so this is something that has not existed. And I think, you know, we're right now, it's kind of interesting because, you know, you think about the state of French right now in New Brunswick, and it's quite healthy, actually. You know, a school like École Sainte-Anne, you know, it started as a schoolhouse with like 10 students.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they built it up from such a small place. And so now we're talking to them, trying to get their playbook, seeing how they did it, you know, and grow it, something like that. But anyway, so my mother has started a foundation. And so she's raising funds for this language immersion program that's going to be going on. So if people wanted, you know, a real tangible way to help out, you know, our linguistic revitalization, then yes. Then this would be a perfect way to do it. So, and I'll type to you the
send
name
me the
of
link
it.
And we'll put it right in the link on the YouTube link. So when people watch it, cause this will stay up on YouTube. So we'll put it up there and people will be able to see it.
Oh, brilliant. Okay.
That's amazing.
It was so nice to chat.
Thanks so much. Thanks. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Take care.
Peace.
Bye.
I just love that conversation with Jeremy Dutcher. He's such a special artist, such a special, keen intellect. He's so smart. I love doing this. I just lose myself in these conversations. I forget that I'm even hosting a show most of the time. And I really do hope that you enjoy it as much as I do. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. If you want to get in touch, I'm on Twitter at Miles David, on Instagram at David Miles. Remember, tell your friends about the show. We're trying to build something, trying to do it for many more years to come. Miles from Home will keep the shows coming. Thanks again for listening. Take care. We'll see you again soon.